Hello and welcome to the North Star. I'm your host, David Perel, the founder of North Star Media, and this is the North Star Podcast. This show is a deep dive into the stories, habits, ideas, strategies, and rituals that guide fulfilled people and create enormous success for them. And while the guests are diverse, they share profound similarities. They're guided by purpose, live with intense joy, learn passionately, and see the world with a unique lens. With each episode, we get to jump into their minds, soak up their hard-earned wisdom, and apply it to our lives. My guest today is Jason Stein, a general partner at Steins, an investment management business and holding company that provides capital and strategic partnership to consumer brands, media, and technology companies. Jason also founded Laundry Service, an advertising agency that sold to Wasserman Media Group in 2015. And full disclosure, I worked for Jason at Cycle Media, the sister company of Laundry Service, and that's where we met. And in this episode, we talk about the direct-to-consumer commerce wave, sports advertising, and also the future of marketing. And this conversation begins with the story of how Jason used Twitter to recruit me back when I was a senior in college. I hope you enjoy this episode. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You've been, of course, a CEO and spent time with some of the top people in the media industry. And so you're at the top there, but also go really low in terms of like really being on the front lines of Twitter and being really active in terms of what's happening on social media. I don't see a lot of other CEOs doing that. And that's something that I've always admired about you.
I think from a business perspective and a human perspective, there's a huge change occurring right now, right? Like, content's becoming a bit of a commodity where everything, it's a sea of sameness across the social channels and this bite-sized content. And it doesn't necessarily matter how great a photo of a new Nike off-white collab is. People are going to buy that no matter what, right? You could spend $100,000 on an ad with Wieden Kennedy, or you could take a photo on your smartphone in the factory and leak it. It's going to go viral, and then you're going to release it, and then everybody's going to buy it, right? The genius in the marketing there is that is the collab, right? And the energy that was created by bringing someone relevant to the Nike customer who did something very different than create sports product. They were creating designer contemporary fashion and bring that together in a way that was meaningful. And it was a sellout before you did any marketing, right? That's the brilliance there. So I think marketing has to move way up the chain to product development, right? And I think marketing, as you know it today, is a commodity. It's literally just sharing what the product is.
Talk more about the idea of it moving up to product development. I have some ideas of what that looks like, but it's not immediately clear to me what that means.
It's the Virgil collab is the perfect example, right? It's thinking about how to create a product and bring people, whether it's a collab or self-lacing sneakers with Nike to, or Oakley has these new glasses with speakers in them, right? And it can't be kitschy and it can't be gimmicky, right? It has to be actually meaningful. But if you can bring the marketing team into the product development, or people who have an understanding of marketing at that level and have that inform features or collaborators or entire new products to begin with, right? Because marketing is who's talking directly to the customer, right? Then I think you don't necessarily need to worry about how much you spend on ads, right? Or on content. You need to have them, but you don't have to overdo it. And by the way, that's how it happens in the auto industry, right? Marketing, being in a high-level marketing position at Ford means you actually work on the product with the product team from a very early stage, years before it's even there's an actual car.
Talk more about that. So what you're doing as a marketing director is you are working with the product development team, thinking about what are the sort of features that are really going to resonate with our audiences. And then the product development, the design, and marketing are all fused together in one, rather than product development design going and doing their thing and then handing off the messaging to the marketing team after the product has been launched.
First off, I think that's how it happens at a lot of companies or in certain industries. Yeah, but that's the idea, is just thinking with a marketing mind and marketability of product design and giving people what you know that they will buy. If you're relying on marketing to sell your product instead of product development to sell your product, you probably have a commoditized product.
One of the first interviews I ever did was with the founders of a almost like a toy stuffed animal company called Squishables.
Yeah.
And almost all of their toys were actually designed from the bottom up by their fans. And so what they did was they almost had a Reddit style votes where fans would submit designs and whatnot, and then the fans would actually vote on which ones they wanted. So then they had buy-in before they had even started creating the content. They had outsourced their product development to their community.
Yeah, crowdsourcing is not a new concept. It's been around for a long time. I think executing it properly and doing it well is always, you know, the hard part, but execution is the hard part with anything. Everyone has good ideas. Very few actually act on them and see them through to fruition. But back to social media. So besides the idea of content becoming a commodity and marketing being less of a differentiator than product itself, which is, again, probably not the newest concept in the world, but more and more clear now. But I think more broadly speaking, a lot of the behaviors that social media has brought out, I used to say that it's just an amplification of the real world, right? It's just if you were vain in the real world, you're vain on social media. If you're materialistic in the real world, you're materialistic here. If you're very sociable or friendly or funny, you're here. But now I actually think it takes those behaviors and takes them to extremes and makes it even more so, right? And you know, you're speaking about your experience on Twitter. I commend Twitter for what they're doing right now with the drastic changes they're considering undergoing, taking off the retweets and the like buttons, because what Twitter has done for the world, and I think Jack has spoken about this a few times, is taking everything to an extreme, right? To be successful on Twitter, you have to have an extremist point of view, right? It could be positive extremist self-help. It could be negative extremist about, you know, politics. It could be hyperbole about influencers, which you frequently espouse. We can get into that. But by the way, that was me 5 years ago, right? You have to make a name for yourself. You tweet things that, you know, a young audience who is on social media a lot is your audience will retweet a lot, right? And then a journalist sees it and they're like, oh, he's an expert on influencers. And then all of a sudden they're interviewing you for an article on CNBC. You're speaking at a Bloomberg event, right? Like, this just happened to you. And by the way, I did the same thing. Mm-hmm. But you're not actually tweeting something that is completely accurate, right? There's no nuance to it. And nothing in the world is super binary, right? Like, very few things, especially in business, are binary. And you probably know that when you're tweeting it, right? But it's bait and it's trolling. And that's how Donald Trump became president, right? To his credit, he manipulated the social media and the internet with extremist points of view. Whether or not he believes them, I don't think anybody knows, or including himself. So I don't know that. I think there's been a lot of good from Twitter and learning and from Instagram at exposing brands and people to big audiences. But certainly the idea of FOMO, materialism, jealousy, vanity, hyperbole, extremism, is not healthy, right? And you've seen it in elections globally that extremist political leadership has won all over the world because of this. And I think the more we can get away from an extremist society, the better we'll all be, because the reality of things is rarely on the extremes, right? It's usually being moderate. Everything in moderation is the saying everyone says all the time, but nothing is in moderation on social media. You're addicted to the dopamine hit. Right, you're checking for how many retweets you got. You're deleting it if you didn't get enough engagement. So that's sort of where my point of view has evolved to.
Yeah. Okay. So my natural reaction to what you're saying is I agree, but I just don't know that if what you're saying is actually like feasible in terms of business models. At least it's not clear to me at all what that looks like. And it seems like the world is on this trend, this perpetual trend towards shorter hits, faster snippets, what I call like a shorter now, where we're just sort of compressing the news cycle. And like what's happening now goes from a day to an hour to maybe even shorter.
All right, hold on, because there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
One, it's not necessarily true that the world is only watching these shorter snippets, right? Like HBO and Netflix would be the perfect example that that's not the case, right? Like long form programming, when you invest a lot of money in it to decommoditize the product, is doing fantastic, right? Whether you're talking about Black Panther or, you know, any one of the Oscar films, Black Klansman, like, unbelievable film. Have you seen that? Mm-hmm. You got to get out there, man. You're just living, what are you living in Instagram and Twitter all day?
Not Instagram, Snapchat? Twitter. Just Twitter.
It's not clear to me that short form program is the only type of programming that's being watched, I think probably more time or as much time is being spent on long form, high end content that's not a commodity like what's on social media. Sports is, I don't put sports in short form content, and people are watching a ton of sports, right? Certainly highlights are consumed that way by people who aren't watching live. But so I think that's one. Two, to your point about business models, it's not clear what the solve is for this, right? And I don't fault Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey for not doing it sooner, because this is the natural evolution of their businesses and their platforms. And when they started them, they weren't thinking, what do we do when we have a billion people using it every day? How do we have to change the way it all works together? You know, yeah. It's not, you're trying to survive every day as an entrepreneur. But to their credit, they are both potentially disrupting themselves as we speak, right? Facebook has said that it's going to, Zuck himself is leading a charge to encrypt everything and become a messaging first platform, right? And consolidate Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram together. That's crazy, right? Like, that could put their advertising business at risk over time. They've lost Chris Cox, Mark's number one product guy, Chris Daniels, who is running WhatsApp. This just happened yesterday, right? Because they were not necessarily in agreement with this pivot, right? And Jack is and Twitter are talking about removing the retweet count and the favorite count from tweets, right? Which is like, wow. But I would probably, people will tweet a lot more when they don't have to be embarrassed about getting less engagement, right? But I think the bigger point is that they're willing to do this for the better of society, for the better, the health of their own platforms.
Well, it sounds like when I was hearing you talk about the longer form stuff, what jumped to my mind was I was thinking of Twitter, short snippets, and then I was thinking of longer written snippets. But it might be that people say all the time to me, well, people don't read anymore. People don't read anymore. My site.
That's not true, though.
Exactly. That's not true at all. But I'm still not sure that we're going to get an order of magnitude more people reading long form. But to your point about
what's happening. But again, it depends how you define long form, right? Like, I read a lot of books. People read a lot of novels on the beach over the summer, right?
But I don't think that that's a growth industry. I think that the growth would be in long form video, sort of like what you were saying with documentaries and with movies. And I think that that's where this long form, more nuanced, more deliberate content is going to go.
But I'm talking about the broad statement of people don't read anymore, right? Like, if you look at all the things people read, of course they read. And if you look at all the long form content that people watch on video, they still watch a lot of long form content. And I think the problem when a new platform or a new way to consume information comes about, like social media, people automatically assume that the traditional or the legacy platform is gone forever and dead, right? And certainly they're going to evolve meaningfully, right? But to think that the only thing people are going to consume are short form snippets anymore is probably not accurate today, and not going to be accurate going forward. It's a big part of it, and it will take attention from other things people used to do. But it's not the only thing that's happening.
Do you remember what the number one lesson that you taught me about business at laundry service was? It was always be paranoid. And it's an interesting mirror into what we've been talking about with Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey.
Yeah, well, Zuckerberg probably wasn't paranoid enough given all the things that have happened over the past few years with privacy and the elections and so forth. But that's an interesting lesson. I don't even remember saying that to you, but it's definitely an entrepreneurial mindset. And when you're in the heat of entrepreneurship and many successful people, they're always planning for a worst case scenario, right? And a lot of people think that entrepreneurship is like this Elon Musk way of, you're just hitting for the moon every day. You're swinging for the grand slam. But I think a large part of why, any success I've had as an entrepreneur is because I was just thinking about the worst case scenario and planning for what happens when that happens. And because sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But if you have a play for how to prevent it, and you can identify a problem early enough, there's always a solution. The problem is when a problem occurs and you don't have a solution ready, or you haven't started to solve for it ahead of time.
Well, I would say Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg was very paranoid just around the wrong things. Like, he was very paranoid, of course, with Snapchat. They tried to buy the company. Then they launched Slingshot, that horrible app, and then all these other things. And I think that he was just really paranoid about emerging competition and not paranoid about some of the things we've discussed.
Look, when you're the biggest platform in the world, period, like the number one place people go to every day and by far the largest in the history of the world, then I think it's hard to keep track of all these things. And again, I don't fault them for what they did or didn't do, but I think it's cool to see what's happening now. And I'm I'm one of the few people who have faith that they're going to get it right. But as far as the your lesson that I taught you, there's another side to that, right? To be a successful entrepreneur, you have to simultaneously be incredibly bullish and confident and excited about the future, extremely optimistic, right? And simultaneously, you have to be extremely concerned and paranoid and worried. And that is the crux to me about why entrepreneurship is bad for mental health. Is you have to live in this sort of bipolar world as a young entrepreneur to be successful. Aside from not sleeping and worry, everything you have to worry about, and figuring out the product, you have to be both of those things at all times.
Did you feel like when you were building Laundry Service, you had the same level of both of those throughout the entire time? Or was it sort of like a bull charging towards a destination, and then at some certain point, maybe you crossed 50 employees, 100 employees, moved to some new office where the rent was high, then it was like, whoa, I really need to bifurcate my own mentality?
I was always equally optimistic and paranoid, but I was definitely a bull running toward a destination, which was to build a big agency and sell it. You can't really share the paranoia as paranoia to the team, because you just want them to be excited and confident, right? That's something that you have to keep to yourself. Maybe you share with your wife, who, you know, lucky for me, worked at the company. But I would say the paranoia comes out in to the other teams through questions you ask, through product ideas that you have, through direction that you're giving, through organizational shifts that you make, right, to change the company is more how it comes out. You're not saying like, I'm worried we're going to go under if we don't do this, you know, unless you really need to motivate them, in which case you might say something like that, right? And sometimes I did. But, you know, Laundry Service was very successful because in a commoditized space, the services industry, right? Generally speaking, about ad agencies or accounting firms or law firms, right? A new world came out, which was social media, where completely new platforms that had never existed before became really, really important. And people were spending a lot of their time on it. And most agencies and most brands and most people did not have a real good grasp and understanding of what social media was, how it worked, where it was going, and how to leverage it for your own business success. And we happen to be one of the very, very few companies, there's probably only two or three, that were really, really good at it from pre-IPO for Facebook and Twitter through, you know, say a couple years ago. By now, everyone has figured it out, right? And that's why I say it's a commodity. And that's the hard thing about services in general, right? Is everyone can always figure it out eventually, you know? There's no secret sauce to the services business.
Definitely. Well, another thing that I think is hard and something that I struggled with on the sales team was we were always trying to push frontier thinking. And I was actually on Monday night, I was with a friend who works for TikTok, and he had been at
TikTok is my favorite social media app.
It's your favorite?
Hands down.
Okay.
Best mental health app for social media that there is.
Hold that thought. But what he was saying is that he would go to these brands, and these brands were like, look, we think that this is a great app, but they just sort of weren't ready for that. And I wonder if one of the things that futuristic agencies, so to speak, are always going to struggle with is exactly this, that what you're pitching was too far forward. They sort of steer you back, but then where they end up steering you back to is the place where there's kind of common knowledge around the best practices, and that then becomes a commodity, even though your thinking is 4 or 5 years ahead of the actual work that you're doing.
Yeah, that's not uncommon, especially not in the media business. So you're talking about Cycle, which was an influencer management and media company and tech platform, right? And you were going to pitch media buyers a brand new product. And like any new investment opportunity, whether you work in finance or you work in media or you work at an agency, right? Because agencies were actually, you were trying to get agencies to pay you, the media company, right? Mm-hmm. It's high risk to do something new, right? Like if you're a brand new VC fund and you're trying to go raise money and you're going to a family office, right? They're going to say like, this is pretty risky. Like you don't have a track record. I don't know you. This is a new product. I like everything you're doing, but let's see how you do for a little while and then come back to me. Right. And I think with, you know, with regard to media investments from media buying agencies, look, it's a lot of work to get your client to sign off on something that's different. It's easy to place a TV ad, right? It's been working forever. No one's getting fired for putting an ad on TV, right? You do an influencer post with the fat Jewish and, you know, your product is like, you know, on his belly in a bowl of life-size avocado, right? And, you know, there's a backlash and all of a sudden you're fired or you're a hero because it went viral, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think people really need that, right? You're pitching a marketing manager who's probably mid-level to convince them to place, you know, a $300,000 to $500,000 buy, is it worth the risk for them? And that's always something that happens. I wrote an article for CNBC probably in like 2012-2013 that is titled "The Ad Dollars Are Moving to Social Media," and just about the idea that they move slowly, then they move really, really fast. We talk about ad dollars, and that's exactly what's happened. Once it became undeniable that it was such a huge place that people spent their time, a lot of money moved to it.
Absolutely. The other big lesson, and then we'll jump into TikTok, that I learned from you, and I remember this really vividly. We were in our annual meeting and you said, make it about the work. You said, above all, make it about the work, and that will take care of so many things. And I remember hearing that, and I felt like at Laundry Service, that was one thing that was good, is people really were judged on the quality of their work more than anything else. And I don't think it was like the coziest place to work, but I think that in terms of being judged on producing great work, I felt like that was always what I was judged on. And I think that was clearly something that you really valued.
Yeah, that's what it was always about, because at that early young stage, I think there were like 100 employees when you were working there, right? We ended up going to 550 before I left. And you don't have a choice but to be about the work, right? You don't have time to like be best friends with everyone at that early stage, because you'll be out of business, you know? And so I think that's also just part of an entrepreneur's mentality, right? Like as an entrepreneur, you're somebody who's new to a business who hasn't proven themselves, right? And you just want to be judged for your quality of work, right? All you want is a meritocracy in a world where there's very little of that, right? Whether you're pitching a new product that's really, really good and you believe in it that people don't want to buy into, or you're a new fund or anything else. And that when an entrepreneur runs a company and you have a founder's initial vision in a company, that's what you get. You get a meritocracy. As companies evolve, you have to become a little more cozy, which we certainly did. And there's pros and cons to that too, by the way. Some people get a little lazier, but it's you know, again, the natural evolution. My belief is that the bigger anything gets, the less quality you end up having. And I don't think we were at that size where that happens, but generally speaking, like a 5,000 person agency, which exists, right? Can you imagine like quality controls and something like that? Crazy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I remember even, I think Laundry Service was a little bit bigger and all the creative had to go through either you or Allison.
Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah.
For a long time it did, until about 250, 300 people. Services is a brutal business, man. Really, really tough business. It's, you know, it's non-scalable. You have to hire, every time you make more money, you have to hire more people, which is the definition of not being scalable, right? It's commoditized. You can't, you don't have really any great ways to differentiate. Your clients will come and go regardless of how good your work is at the end of the day. And I'm excited now to be working in scalable areas of business, right? There's new challenges that come with that, and obviously requires more capital, the good thing about an agency is you have to put no money into it to have an agency, right?
Yeah, you got a client,
and you have a retainer, and you can hire people, and you get another client. Now you can have an office, and it's a 20% bottom line business, and you're bringing home a good amount of money as you scale. And that's an agency. And that's why I did it, because I didn't have money to put into anything, right? But I think once you start to be successful and you start to make money, you start to think about the different ways you could deploy that capital to make more money while doing less, right? That's the ultimate goal, to make money while doing nothing, right? And if you have a lot of money, right, you can just put your money into the S&P and fixed income and make an insane amount of money and never have to work again, right? I don't, many people want to do other things besides that, but that's the extremist idea for that.
Okay, but you don't strike me as someone who doesn't want to do anything. So very much you strike me as somebody who wants to consume information, really understand the landscape, spend time with the top people in the industry, come up with your own strategy, your own kind of board of what of how this entire playing field is going to shape up. And then, if I were to make an assumption here, then deploy capital based off those kinds of theses and then the people that you meet.
Definitely one thing that I'm doing now and I'm excited about. I will say, you know, I would love to have the life of a Dave Perel and be a professional flaneur and walk around Greenwich Village and pop into breathers and record podcasts all day, right? But yeah, I like working. I like building things. I like helping entrepreneurs be successful, which is really the mission for what I'm doing now. I like making money. I like giving back, which making money allows you to do. Yeah, one thing we're doing now through Steins is working with growth stage companies, right? And providing capital and operating, helping operate them, really, really being involved in the operation of it. And obviously deep in the strategy of it too. So it can mean helping manage a P&L, capital allocation, credit facility, board meetings and board management, accounting, legal issues, and so forth, the things that entrepreneurs generally don't want to have to deal with, right? They want to work on the product. Doing that across tech, media, and consumer brands, a little bit of retail. But one thing is, we're not doing VC style investing. We're not going for big valuations. We're not going to give you 5x your revenue. We're not going to give you a $5 million convertible cap on your convertible note just because you formed an LLC yesterday. I think VC investing has obviously been very successful for some big VC funds, right? Incredibly successful. That's not what we're doing. It doesn't excite me. The thesis behind VC requires you to go 2 for 10. At best, right? 8 out of 10 are going to fail. So often 9 out of 10, right? And one will be a unicorn. And I don't want to set companies up to potentially fail, right? If you're a VC fund, you want to get to either failure or unicorn status as quickly as possible with your portfolio companies. So you don't have to keep following on and investing in them, and you can put more capital toward the successful businesses, right? And you spend as much money as you can to grow those companies as quickly as you can to see which ones are gonna stick, right? And that often is not good for the companies, you know? Growth at all costs is obviously not good. Certainly outside of tech, VC generally seems like a challenge proposition. What we're doing is saying, look, we're going to buy into your company at a fair market valuation, the same way you would trade if you were a public company, right? Maybe it's 1x revenue, as an example. Maybe it's 10x EBITDA, even though you're a growing company, because this is the best way for us to be true partners in this. I don't want to have to come to the first board meeting and say, all that stuff we talked about, I changed my mind. You have to grow 10x in the next 2 years, 20x in the next 2 years, or this is a failure for us, right? You're not going to move the needle for our fund. So that does mean taking a lower valuation as an entrepreneur sometimes than you might be able to get from a VC. And for some, the VC route is better. And for others, like the companies we've been working with, the idea of having a partner who's truly helping them scale the business every day and adding a lot of value is worth more than that in equity. So that's what we're doing today.
So I would then assume that your median investment would be slightly later than seed stage after the company has proven that there's a sustainable business model. And because you're getting in later, that's sort of what you're getting in exchange. You're getting a bit more predictability that this is actually a viable business. And then what you can do is you can go in and team up with the operations team and have that strategy that you're talking about be more sustainable.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're coming in when companies have, you know, no less than $1 million of revenue, generally up to $10 million in revenue, and are profitable. We're generally not doing deals where companies are losing money, or, you know, at the very least, they'll be becoming profitable within a year of our investment. And the hope there is we may not have $1 billion exits, right? We might, but we're not setting up to go for $1 billion exits. We'd be really happy with 9 out of our 10 companies, or 8 out of 10, being anywhere from $75 to $150 million exits, right? So, and it could take, you know, however much amount of time it needs to get there. It could be 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. We'll see. We have done some tech, but you know, we're open to good deals with companies that fit that profile.
Yeah. Well, one thing that, you know, you spoke a couple weeks ago at the Front Office Sports event, and what I find to just be a very interesting societal trend, and it something I'm happy about, is it sort of bucks the trend of superficiality, is people are very interested in the business of things. And of course, Front Office Sports goes over the business of sports.
Yeah, but, so we're clear. Front Office Sports, for anyone who doesn't know, and if you work in the sports industry, you likely are well aware of it. It's a publication, a media company that covers the sports business, right? It has a daily email that goes out to a lot of people, a large number. I won't reveal it without the CEO doing it himself. But the people who open it every day, because I get the reports on it, are CEOs of major sports talent agencies and GMs of major NBA teams and VPs at, you know, anything in the sports industry, right? Or anything around the sports, brands like Anheuser-Busch, for example, that are big sponsors of the sports industry. They have events, they have a website that covers this regularly. And the interesting thing about this business is that, generally speaking, this would be considered a trade publication, right? But sports is so broad and so commercial that fans are dying to read more about the business side of sports. And so it really has become a B2C publication as much as B2B. And you see that manifesting itself in the product more and more every day, and you'll continue to see it with the great work that team's doing. Funny enough, that company is growing incredibly fast, even though we're taking a non-VC style approach to growth. That's Adam is an incredible, the founder and CEO of Front Office Sports, a true entrepreneur to the core. The guy just busts his ass 24/7, and I have a hard time seeing that fail just as a bet on him alone. Wow. Another guy I met through Twitter DM.
There we go. Well, I think that idea of getting really into the business thing, and then, as you mentioned, the convergence of B2B and B2C is just going to become more and more common, because it personally, when it comes to sports, when it comes to music, when it comes to stratechery and technology, getting really into the business sides of things is fascinating. And I've always had this idea of a company that I want to start down the road, basically take advantage of what the internet is. And it's basically this idea that I have of metaphor schools, where you just have whatever you're interested in, you can learn about all of these different topics through it. So as a kid, I was really into baseball, and I would have learned so much more in my statistics class, and maybe my communications class, and maybe my, I don't know if I had an urban planning class or something, all through metaphors of baseball would be great. And I think that is exactly the kind of archetype that online schools should take around things. You start with the passion and then bleed down to exactly what you're trying to teach. And that maps on pretty well to Front Office Sports.
Yeah, look, I think anytime you can contextualize anything in life to things that matter to people, you're going to have a better shot at them caring about and understanding it. And there's a book I read a while ago, maybe 10 years ago, about kids with attention deficit disorder and ADHD. I think it was called The Short Bus. And what it talks about in one case study is a kid who they said was off the charts ADD. They wanted to medicate him. He couldn't pay attention in school. He was hyperactive. And then his parents got him a PlayStation, and the kid sat down at the PlayStation and he got, I think he had got Metal Gear Solid. I forget what game it was. And it was one of those deep strategy games where you have to read for probably 5 minutes or 10 minutes at a time to understand what to do in the game, right? And there were subtle nuance and clues on what to do. And the kid sat down and played it for like 2 weeks straight and didn't miss a word and like perfected it. And they were like, wait a second. He maybe have some issues at school, but he clearly doesn't need to be heavily medicated for having ADHD or being hyperactive when he can sit in his room for a week straight playing a video game. Mm-hmm. He just cares a lot more about this video game, right? And I think that's a sort of a life hack that you could apply to anything.
It's as if the variance on your attention is bigger. And actually, I think that's how I am, is I much more of like a tail. So I'm probably more disengaged than the average person until I'm engaged, but then I'm hyper engaged and have the ability to just focus for hours and hours and hours.
Hey, you work on things that you care about. It's a common entrepreneurial trait, right? When you really care about something, you'll do it until you're, you know, passed out on the floor. But if you don't really, really care for whatever reason, you're sort of out of luck. The thing I always challenge entrepreneurs to think about is, why is it that you care about this? Or why is it that you care about a certain thing? And it usually comes back to setting like their specific life goals, right? They want to work for themselves, or they want freedom or financial freedom, or they want to make a ton of money, or they want to prove themselves to someone, or they hate working for other, like there's a million things, but it usually comes back to like, what is your goal in life? What are your three or four biggest goals? And then it's usually always a function of that. But once you have goals, it's really easy to optimize how to spend your time every day.
So TikTok, tell me why you think TikTok is so interesting. You jumped when I mentioned it and want to hear why.
It's fun. It's just fun. There's nothing else to it. It's fun. You sit there, and first of all, it has a great UI and UX that definitely innovates on Instagram and Snapchat. But it's just a fun app. You just go on there to enjoy yourself, to smile and to laugh. And I actually watch it in my son's bed with him at night for like 10 minutes before we go to bed. And like, now I walk into my room every night with like the biggest smile on my face, right? Like where I would used to be like, oh, let me go have a glass of wine, like wind down now. Like I'm so euphoric from just spending like 10 minutes laughing my ass off with my son on this app. So, you know, maybe it's a flash in the pan sort of thing, like Vine was. Maybe it's something more than that. But the idea that a social media platform exists just to make people happy and just to have fun on it in a world where the current social media platforms have become so far removed from that, I just appreciate that. I enjoy it.
Do you think that it's an issue in America that it's owned by a Chinese company? Does that mean that there's an opportunity, or is that something that you think about?
It's probably a bit of an issue given the state of things now, but an issue in what sense, right? Like, again, because it's just watching funny videos, you're not necessarily giving your financial information today. It's not an issue. In the future, it could certainly become an issue. We'll see.
Now, are there aspects of TikTok that you think could apply very well in terms of the next generation of social media, such as a purely algorithmic feed? Like if you look at basically all of these social media companies, Facebook started off as a chronological news feed, pivoted into the algorithm, Twitter did it, and there was a lot of pushback from especially the power users. Do you think that more and more the answers—
There was a lot of pushback, and then everybody loved it and started using it more, and monthly and daily active users went up, and the company's stock price did a complete 180. Mm-hmm. And RIP Twitter trended for a weekend, and then it moved on. So I don't think that necessarily giving people what they want to see based on algorithms is a bad thing.
Can we talk about the nothing is binary? What my question that I have for you is, the single thing that you have said most to me in our interactions is that nothing is binary. And I've thought a lot about that. And what I struggle with in terms of like getting in terms of how do you balance the idea that nothing is binary with the audacity to attack something with vigor and like a bull charging towards a goal and a mission?
Yeah, it's what is it? Strong ties, loosely held, or whatever it is.
Strong views, weakly held.
Strong views, weakly held. And I'm going to look on my phone right now for a Jeff Bezos quote about this too. But I think you can have a strong point of view. You just have to understand that there's a lot of different ways of getting there, right? So, hold on. So there's a Jeff Bezos quote that says, we are stubborn on vision, we are flexible on details, right? So like, you can have a vision for what you want to achieve, and you can have a vision for what's going to happen in the world, but you have to understand that getting there is usually never a straight line. It's a loop-de-loop, right? Ups and downs. But there's a big difference between analyzing something happening in the world and being successful yourself, right? And you can have a vision for a business, right? And you can try to go achieve it. And you have to be open to pivoting and changing as you go on every day, right? And nothing lasts forever, right? Like, nothing is a straight up shot. Nothing is perfect, and nothing is in business is always horrible, right? There's always an opportunity to get better and to change. So
a couple weeks ago, I tweeted the direct-to-consumer commerce wave can be explained by three things: low startup costs, infinite digital shelf space, and targeting advertising platforms. And I think that from those three things, low startup costs, infinite digital shelf space, and targeted advertising platforms, that right there is why there's been this explosion of direct-to-consumer companies in the last, say, 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, I think that's true. I just think that we have to define what is explosion of D2C, how much market share relative to all consumer brands is D2C, and how many D2C brands are still making a lot of money at wholesale, right? It's those are certainly reasons why D2C can exist today, but how many D2C brands have really hit scale?
Well, in the way I understand it is that what they're doing is they're just growing top line revenue as much as possible. They don't have great unit economics,
right?
And then they're getting bought, and these big companies.
But how
are
many
saying,
of those have actually happened, right? There haven't been a lot of huge, you know, Beats by Dre deals. And by the way, Beats was a huge retail company, including especially when it was acquired, right? Meaning they were distributing through wholesalers. The idea that that's happening is that D2C is growing is accurate. But I think what you start to see happen is a lot of companies in the $10 to $100 million range that usually on the lower end that are sort of like paper cutting their way together to disrupt traditional retail, right? But many D2C brands are, like you said, just leveraging VC capital to grow top line and aren't actually stable, right? And the healthiest exit, if you look at all the data on like what, where, how much D2C companies will get acquired for in the coming years, when you take out the outliers, what is it like
Dollar Shave Club?
Yeah, what did they even get acquired for?
1.2 billion.
Yeah,
something like that.
Yeah, so you always have like a few outliers like that were early in the space, and it was a smart strategic acquisition, right? Similar to Instagram, but most of the D2C acquisitions we see in the coming years will be in the, you know, 75 to 150 million range. And I think it's because you really do need, for a lot of these companies, many D2C brands to be wholesale, to be at wholesale or to become a wholesale platform yourself, right? Amazon can easily become D2C because it's the platform already, right? Netflix can become D2C, meaning it makes its own content and distributes it because it's the platform already. Kith can become a massive, I'm naming some big D2C platforms that are becoming the biggest D2C brands, right? Really, truly some of the biggest D2C brands because they had the platform already. Kith and Netflix are the same thing, right? They license essentially content, right? Kith was buying it wholesale and Netflix was licensing it, and they got huge audiences because of all the third-party product they were bringing into its platform. Kith was getting Nike and New Balance and Off-White, and Netflix was getting all of the, you know, The Office and Friends and everything else. And they collected a ton of data on all of the customers who were consuming it, and they started to say, hey, we could make a much higher margin if we take all this data and start making it ourselves and going direct to consumer with a higher margin, right? So direct to consumer is great, but just like with content, the platforms always win in the end. The platforms are always the better business, and eventually the platforms decide to get into the content business to increase their own margins.
Right. So then, of course, there's direct-to-consumer companies that then try to go past Amazon or really try to own their own platforms, and they do that through...
But there's not... How many are there that you can name off the top of your head?
Well, the real question is how many are there that I can name off the top of my head who are profitable with good unit economics now?
Yeah, or
and
I'm not have sure any kind of scale.
Right, exactly. I think that the reason why there's a wave is because investors seem to sense that there's big opportunity there, but I wouldn't say that we've figured out what that model is yet. And I think that people sense that there's potential there, but I don't think it's been proven.
There's also the idea that there's not that many products that you need to singly buy from one place, right? Like razor blades were a cool thing to have as a subscription, but you could also get razor blades in a lot of other places, right? Clothing, you can get in a lot of different places, right? Like, is the direct-to-consumer business at any one single clothing brand better than the Barney's or the Neiman Marcus experience, right, on their website where there's a collection of brands and customer service, or Amazon, for example, right? Mm-hmm. It's always easier to buy something on Amazon if you can, you know? So I think there's a lot of questions. I think D2C is a critical piece of the playing field, but I think any brand, modern brand, needs to have diversified revenues, right? Just like it's become clear that media companies need to have advertising, subscription, events, and product and commerce now. Consumer brands need to have direct to consumer is by far the most important because you can own the brand and you should scale it most, as, you know, and invest the most in that. Wholesale is still an important piece of the puzzle because they're A, meaningful revenue, even if it's at a lower margin. And B, they help your unit economics a lot because your total volume that you're producing of any product goes up, which means the costs go down at your factories, right, and your shipping and everything else. And they also pre-buy your product. So if you're a direct-to-consumer brand, you have to buy and take a risk on all the inventory that you're buying, right, ahead of time. When I say buy, I mean manufacture, import to the country if it's not being made here, and then you sit on it until you sell it, right? With wholesale, you show them an idea, right? They place an order, you make it for them, right? If you happen to make an extra 1,000 units of that product or 2,000, you can put it on your site, but your minimums are covered, your costs are covered generally because of wholesale. So anyone who wants to be a direct-to-consumer business out of the gates and have scale better have a lot of money because you have to be able to buy all of that inventory up front.
Now, how would you think about the trade-off between giving your products and selling them to wholesale, selling them on Amazon, and sure, you get the diversified revenue streams through that, but how much would you then value the data that then comes from selling directly, and how important do you think that is in terms of factoring the equation of how much you should own your revenue streams versus dishing them out on wholesale and Amazon?
D2C is the name of the game. You want to be a D2C business. The goal is to be a D2C business and grow it and never have to do wholesale ever again. If you can become a profitable, healthy business at D2C, you may cut wholesale and have a little less revenue, a little less profit just because of the headache that it occurs, or you might have more cost savings by cutting wholesale because you need sales guys and account managers and all this other stuff. But they can return to you or they can discount and your margins can go down. But you want to own the data. You want to own the customer.
The last thing that I want to talk to you about is just why is sports advertising so not great? Like, I was watching the Sixers play the Pacers over the weekend, and ESPN has, in their streaming, instead of showing a commercial, just says the game isn't playing now. And you've discussed this before. Like, that's a perfect opportunity for an ad to come in and a company to, I don't know, maybe do a advertising about Joel Embiid, and that's a 1 minute spot on something that happened recently that still seems like really lucrative ad space that hasn't been taken advantage of, and I don't understand why that hasn't happened yet.
It's just because it's too much work and it's not that scalable, and like you said earlier, you're asking a media buyer to do more than they need to do. If, like, placing a 30 second spot that someone hands to you, the creative agency hands a media buyer a 30-second spot, you can place it across the world in TV spots, and your job is done, right? What you're saying, integrating into the program, is hard and time-consuming and a little messy, and anytime creative gets involved, it's a whole big back and forth. And then they have to get it on the TV show in the right way, so there's all these different parties getting mixed in. And the reality is, like, I don't know that it makes any difference. It probably doesn't in the performance of the ad, right? I just don't know that it does. I think building a great product is the best way to build a great brand, and obviously having the values you stand behind, right, having a point of view on the world as a brand the way Nike does is and Red Bull does is important. That's why they're great brands. I think none of them are the biggest advertisers, the biggest TV advertisers in the world. They don't make the most content in the world. Apple's the same way, right? Its ad budget relative to Samsung is pretty small, I believe. So I think it's more about having great product that is highly marketable, right? It could be a folding phone, for example. And and having a great brand, and then having good, you know, the direct response advertising does work across the internet. Obviously, you never want to be too reliant on that, but you know, the brand advertising that everybody espouses being so critical, I don't really know. In today's world, where people are seeing so much in so many places and not watching TV spots because they're looking at their phones and not seeing these ads on their phones because they're scrolling through their feeds, it's hard for me as someone who now owns brands to invest too much in brand advertising as opposed to invest in product and do what you need to do on community comms and bottom funnel and owning your audience through email, etc. It's very different than what my point of view was as an agency, right? As a business owner, as a brand owner, it's almost complete opposite of what I would have recommended when I was running an agency. But yeah, that's the truth. An agency's job is to grow the agency, right? Mm-hmm. Which means you want to get people to do the sexiest ads they can with you, right? Yeah. Big spots, win a Cannes Lion, you know, get on TV at the Super Bowl, etc., right? You just want to do that because you can make more money and you can win awards and you can grow in your career, right? Everybody just wants what's best for themselves, and that's what any agency would do, right? As they should, you know? Whereas when you own a brand, you just want to grow the brand, you know? So when you work, people will say, oh, but the best way to grow the agency is to grow the brand and all that stuff. But unless you have skin in the game, you can never really think the same way as an owner. Totally different.
Jason Stein, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Dave.
Hey again, it's David here one more time. Before you leave, I want to tell you about an online course I teach called Rite of Passage. In it, I'll show you how to accelerate your career by writing and sharing your ideas. I've taken everything I've learned from interviewing some of the world's most effective people on this podcast and distilled those lessons into a powerful set of principles for creating your own body of work. If you've always wanted to start writing online and build your professional network, this is the place to start. You can find out more on my website, Perel.com.